Hey, all you improv nerds. If you've always wanted to work with me, Jimmy Corain, and my Art of Slow Comedy improv method, hey, now's the time because you don't even have to leave your house because my Art of Slow Comedy Level 1 classes are online. I'm offering two sections. That's right. Two sections this winter. The first one starts Wednesday, February 17th from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Standard Time. And the second one will be offered Fridays starting from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Central Standard Time. So don't delay. Go to my website right now, or we'll wait till the podcast is over and sign up at jimmycorain.com, jimmycorain.com, or just go to the website if you need more information and you can't get enough of me. That's jimmycorain.com, the Art of Slow Comedy, Level 1.
Jimmy, Jimmy Corain, Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Oh,
hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, the host of Improv Nerd, and our guest today is Brendan Sullivan. I've known Brendan for close to 30 years, and we first met at the Improv Olympic, when they called it the Improv Olympic. That's how far back we go. And he was on probably the best Herald team there, Blue Velveeta. And we talked to him about what it was like to be on that team and to find your place on that team. He also shares with us how older improvisers like ourselves can play with the younger generation. And then we talked to him about the death of his 24-year-old son, Charlie, who died last year after taking a hit of cocaine laced with fentanyl. Before we get to this interview with Brendan, I really enjoy interviewing people like Brendan who are friends that I started out with. I've known close to 30 years, and you know we've talked on the phone for years, and you know, and you have a rapport, and you don't really have to do much research because you know their lives. And for me, it's also like being transported back in a time machine, and you kind of relive the fun part and the joy of when you work together with this person. And the other thing I think that's interesting is when Brendan and I work together, and we worked together after Blue Velveeta, there was a group called the Comedy Underground. It was some people at Blue Velveeta and Jazz Freddy and some other Herald people, you know, from other teams. And it was a really good group. And we weren't that close then. And then over the years, our friendship has, you know, has developed and we're closer. And it's just interesting because, you know, who you think you're going to be friends with for a long time when you first start out, and who you actually end up with being friends with is usually totally different. And I just have a lot of gratitude for the friends that I do have and that I've made in improv. So I think that's all I really need to say. You're going to really enjoy this interview. It's the Brendan Sullivan interview. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Brendan Sullivan, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
My pleasure, Jimmy.
You grew up on the South Side, a big Irish Catholic family. And when I knew you, you were working for the New York Times. You sell advertising space, right, which I would imagine would have been very lucrative back then. And you had a building and we were like, oh, my God, this guy is an adult. And yeah. I was just thinking to myself, you know, you were in the corporate world doing very successful. Why would you decide to try improv?
Yeah, I'm still asking myself that, Jimmy. Yeah, it was weird. You're right. I was making a ton of money, you know. And I bought this house, and I started taking improv classes on the side just out of curiosity. I've been going to Second City, watching it, and thinking, wow, that looks like a lot of fun up there. And then I learned about the Players Workshop and I started taking classes there and I got good feedback, like maybe you could do this. And so I started doing the, they called it the Training Center then. Now it's the Conservatory.
It's Second City.
Yeah. And it started getting harder and harder to get to work every morning. And although I was making, like you said, a lot of cash, I saw most of the people who were at my level at that company were 30 years older than me. And they had their second home and their kids went to private colleges and they had their golf club membership. And I mean, they were set for, you know, and, but I still saw them dragging their butts into this office every day. And I'm like, whoa, this is the price they're paying for that. And I think most people, if they are after the money, if that's their goal, they don't hit it at 26 or 28. They hit it in their 40s and their 50s when it's too late to change to do anything else. I looked at my counterparts walking through the office, wonderful, wonderful human beings, but they just felt like Willy Loman to me. And I thought this, I could see my entire future laid out in front of me, that this is where it would be. And it was pretty predictable. And I took a look at the math and realized that, you know, I had the house, which was a two flat. So I had rental income and I had all this cash. So I could quit, not make it 28. I could quit, not make a penny for 3 years at least. And if I fell flat on my face and nothing happened, I'd be 31. Big deal. Go back to making a lot of money. At least I gave it a shot. And now it's been, what, over 30 years, and I'm still out here. I haven't gone back to it, and I don't think they'd want me now. But
there's nothing to go back to in newspaper advertising.
No, no, that's that train has left the station.
And I think I know I did. I always looked at you as an adult because you had that job and because you had a two flat. What was it like for you to deal with people like, I mean, improvisers? You had come from the corporate world, and improvisers were like, you know, getting up at 12 o'clock, you know, drinking all, you know, eating unhealthily, all that stuff. Not very responsible, especially in our 20s. What was that adjustment like for you?
Yeah, it was a little strange because, like, I was 28, you know, when joined, and most of the people that I knew were like 22, 23 that were doing improv. And you're right, they hadn't had that background, and they looked at me as this older person, even at 28. And I dove into that. Once I quit, I dove into that lifestyle myself. I might have been a little old to do it, but I dove into it wholeheartedly, into this sleeping until noon and not taking care of myself and, you know, destroying brain cells and all those things. But it was a little odd. It was odd because I didn't have to. I mean, the people that I was working with were doing things like waiting tables and, you know, being a temp or busking in the subway. And, you know, we'd finish our show on Friday, on Saturday night, and I really have nothing I had to do until the show the next Friday night. And so, you know, I'd take classes, I'd read books, you know, I'd sit around the house, you know, I'd do stuff, but it wasn't, there wasn't an urgent, there wasn't a fire in my belly that I needed to make it, you know.
Which I think to me sets up.
And I've proved myself right because I didn't. So.
But you were on a team that was legendary. One of the best Herald teams that I've ever seen at the Improv Olympic. It was Improv Olympic back then. Now it's IO Chicago, called Blue Velveeta. And these guys were big personalities, a lot of egos, very super driven, really talented group, different styles. Everybody had kind of a different style. How did you fit in?
Yeah, I felt like I was Bud Abbott or Dickie Smothers. You're right. They're all wonderful human beings. And I loved every moment of being in Blue Velveeta. And I didn't plan on this, but I tended to serve as a counterpoint to all these, you know, you can't have everybody, you know, being a big personality in the center and get anything done. It's just chaos. So I found a role for myself, which was to tie things together, say yes, and sit back and watch the big picture and see where I might be able to tie something together. But I didn't have that, need to, I just didn't have a big personality. It wasn't like I chose to sit back. It was just who I was and who I am to be that, more centered, I sometimes even felt like I took the point of view of the audience and said and brought in what the audience was thinking while all this was going on. So
Did you ever feel like, oh, I'm not good enough to play with these guys, or intimidated?
You know, being older than most of them helped with that. I think if I was 22 or 23 and had done that, I probably would have felt that more than I did. I needed to get my yayas from other places. What I mean is that people would come up to me after the show and say, "You guys were really good. That guy was really funny. You guys were really good." Yeah. And I just say, well, yeah, that's absolutely the fact. And there's no way that I can compete with those people. I'm going to just have to collaborate with those people. But usually to an audience of people who didn't know improv, they would see me as they wouldn't recognize what I was doing up there. And yeah, really didn't care. But that's the impression that I got. So yeah, it was intimidating at times to be up there and just know that I could get steamrolled if I wasn't paying attention.
Was there a point, a moment on stage in a show where you were like, "Oh, I got this. I feel really confident. I found my place. I found where I belong on this team."
Wow, I don't know that I can remember an exact moment like that. I think, there were times when I really felt like I was really in the groove and not looking from the outside. But I can't remember an exact moment of that. I really, I have to tell you, lived so much. I believed so much in living in the moment that a week later, someone could stop me on the street, and they did. And go, "Hey, man, I saw you guys last week. I remember when you did this, you stepped in and did this and tied this together." And I go, "I don't remember that." Just because, improv is so in the moment that when it's over, it's over. And yeah, there are definitely particular performance pieces that we did that I remember. Oh, that was a wild night. That was that night in particular. We were hitting on all cylinders and I was hitting on all cylinders. But being a part of a group like that, it happened a lot, I can't remember a particular moment.
Do you remember a show that stuck out to you that like, "Oh my God, this is, we're doing Harold"?
There were a number of them where you'd walk off stage and the feeling, at least that I had when we walked off stage, was holy crap. What just happened out there? We were so, it just floated. There was a show we did that was, it's kind of a creep. And there's a bunch of them, but the one that just pops into my mind right now is that it happened to be the exact day of the 25th anniversary of Kennedy being assassinated. And I know that's the joke would be, even in my group, "Do you remember when Kennedy was assassinated?" John F. And it was the 25th anniversary of that. And we got a theme. This was at a place called At the Tracks. And we got a theme for our Harold for the tortoise and the hare. And somehow or another in the monologues at the beginning, something came up about, in America, you're told that anybody can be born to be raised up to be president of the United States. But we know that you have to be a man, you have to be white, you have to be rich, you have to be connected. It's not true. It's not slow and steady wins the race, because these guys have a big advantage over us. We're not starting at the same starting line. So that came from the theme. And at the end of the show, I don't want to talk too much about this, but there were two scenes. One scene took place in a gas station, and the other scene, these people had in a car driving to Dallas. And it had nothing to do particularly with, that monologue about Kennedy. but these two things are happening and they're filling their gas tank and then they hop back in their car. And so these two scenes have come together, and the only two people who are not in the scene right now are me and Susan Messing. And we're standing, as you will, at Harold in the back. And I look at her, she looks at me, and we know who we are. And for some reason, I just start doing this. I'm waving, by the way, those of you who are listening on this audio, waving. And she's, so we've acknowledged that we are Jack and Jackie Kennedy in Dallas.
In the car
in Dallas, waving. And then the music starts, and Dave Adler was an amazing, amazing accompanist, and he starts playing Imagine by John Lennon. And I, in slow motion, go through the, and, you know, being hit, being shot. And the lights go down, and he's still playing Imagine. And it was the creepiest. You know, we certainly were not going for a laugh at all. We were just in the moment, and that's what happened. And I think that was a really powerful moment that had nothing to do with being funny. But when the show ended, when the lights went down and that, dead silence in the audience for about 10 seconds. And then they erupted in applause, but it was that powerful and creepy a moment. Those are the moments that really stuck out to me. But that's one of them.
So you've had time, you know, it's been a long time since, you know, 30 years. Why did that team work so well? Why did Blue Velveeta, with all its personalities and all its different styles, why do you think it works so well?
I think, well, first of all, we started with a chip on our shoulder. When we first got together, there was a, you were on one of the other house teams, Tila Mockingbird, and there was a, you know, back then, Improv Olympic was a competition. Mm-hmm. And there were two house teams, Tequila Mockingbird and
Fish Stick. Farley Fish and Stick. Finn and Brian McCann. And
yeah, listen to those names.
I know.
Farley, yeah. Finn, McCann, you know, man, and you guys too, with Noah and you. And
Keckner and Pete Gardner and Madeline Long. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, listen to that. That's what we were up against when we, you know, came there. And unfortunately, that was the I say unfortunately because I was new and didn't realize that, you know, we're all in this thing together. It's we live in a really, really small world if we're thinking that this means anything, improv, you know.
But back then in our heads, it did.
Yeah, but
it was our only, it was our world.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, so you're right. And that, so we came in with a chip out on our shoulder and something to prove. And again, being older than most of the people on my team, I just followed. I didn't really, I wasn't as caught up in, you know, but this chip that some of us had more than others forced us to, that's what motivated us to focus and be there every night. We never mailed it in. We, you know, our warmups before a show were intense. And when we rehearsed, it was intense. And when we talked about the show afterwards, it was intense. And, you know, it was really, we were really, really passionate as a group about it. There were a lot of big personalities on there, but we all kind of found our spot, found our, you know, within that team. And we weren't all the same, you know. We all knew we had different talents. We all knew if somebody called out the musical, you know, that Jay Leggett was going to take over, and well, he should. Mm-hmm. He was an amazing, amazing singer. You know, we were reading each other's minds up there.
How did you, for you know, because you have a very thankless job in terms of tying things together and making things work and yes, anding and playing the straight man to a lot of the scenes. How do you, and I still struggle with it, it's all about getting the laughs. How did you make peace with, you know what, that's my role. I'm just going to accept it.
Well, part of it just had to do with, I just knew I, you know, it wasn't me. I knew myself enough to know that if I ever did push myself to be that person, it wouldn't come out as true, wouldn't come out as honest. It wasn't that I wasn't funny. It's just that my stuff was more subtle. And with all those personalities up there, I really, you know, made a conscious choice. And I'd like to think that that's part of the staying power. I'd like to think that Blue Velveeta had is that there were people like myself who, you know, weren't competing for that big laugh all the time. In my case, it was really because I just couldn't compete with them. But I knew where I stood, and I was fine with that.
Did you enjoy a lot of it, or was it frustrating too?
Oh, I enjoyed it immensely. I wish that I wish I could just put that, you know, time just in a capsule somewhere. It was so much fun. I think while I was doing it, you know, you really don't realize how rare it is. I mean, that was the first improv group I was in, and we just took it to the moon. And, you know, I if it had been my fifth improv group or something, and then I realized, wow, this is it. It might have been different.
But, how would you have enjoyed it more, knowing what you know now?
Well, I mean, certainly through time, just as you age and you realize that, you know, improv is a young person's sport. It's I'm sorry if you're old out there like me, but what I mean is, you're without a care. You know, you can focus and make this your life, and it's all right. When you're 40 or 50 or 60, you can't. You know, life comes along and there's other things to worry about every day. And you can be on stage for that hour or so, but then you have to go back to a kind of a more adult reality. And I love playing, and I, you know, every chance I get, I will play. But then I go back to it, and you can't do that now. You can't just commit your entire life to it.
And you actually experienced that, because when you started to teach for corporate people, you said to me, you're like, I have to go back and do this if I'm teaching this. And you went back to the IO, yeah. And you got on a team. And I'm just wondering, what was that experience like? Now you're performing with the new younger generation who don't know your history.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of them did. In fact, it was funny that after one, and I was with a group called Prefontaine, and Prefontaine was wonderful. I first called Sharna, because Sharna was doing a 10th anniversary show of the IO, the Improv Olympic, whatever it was called at that time. And she wanted Blue Velveeta to come back for the show. And I had been I hadn't been improvising in a while. So I said, Sharna, is there a team that I can go up with a couple of times before get my chops a little back, you know, start riding the bike again. And so she, you know, put me on Prefontaine, and I ended up being on Prefontaine for a bunch of years. One night after a show, a kid, and I can call him a kid in the audience, came up to me afterwards and said, "You were in Blue Velveeta." And I said, yeah, he goes, "My parents saw you." I'm like, "Oh, great." "No, they came home and told the babysitter and me that they'd just seen some really great improv." Okay, I guess that's kind of a backhanded compliment. But yeah, it was a little weird, because most of these people were at least now 15 or 20 years younger than me. And their reference levels are different. Again, you know, they're what was focused in their life was different. There was a point where I was the father of four children doing this. And I looked around and I thought there was like probably six or seven, you know, Improv Olympic teams at that time doing Harold's. And I probably had more children combined than the entire cast of all of those seven teams just in my house. So it was a little different, but they were really great. really talented, and they, you know, they invited me in with open arms, and it was, I really enjoyed doing that.
But so
it was
what different. What would you say to somebody, you know, an older person like us, who's going to play with the younger generation? How did you adjust to them? Because it is faster. It's a different sensibility, I think, than we were starting out.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You got to play your own truth. And that means that you come from your own perspective, whatever that is. I mean, it's not like you're always playing yourself. You don't want to do that. But as far as, you know, your view of the world, you bring that to that performance. And for Prefontaine, that turned out to be a gift, because I was coming from it. For again, older people who were in the audience would come up to me after the show and say, I'm so glad that you added that element about this, because that's what I was thinking too. Because I was coming at it from someone in their 40s or 50, whatever I was then. And that's what you need to do. I wanted to be careful that I didn't end up playing everyone's grandfather in scenes, you know, or everyone's dad or the crazy uncle. But there were times when that seemed right, and that was my truth. And, you know, when they gave a reference to something that I had no idea what they were referring to, because it was something like, you know, Baby Got Back as a song title, I would just have to follow the follower and, you know, say yes and be there and, you know, acknowledge at some point maybe that I didn't know what that, you know, I needed to remember what that, what Baby Got Back meant to me, as opposed to what it meant to a 25-year-old.
So how would you prevent not always playing the grandfather, the dad, the crazy uncle? Would you initiate stuff?
Yeah. You know, I mean, you just try to, because here's the thing, when you're in your late 40s or wherever I was, I used to be in my 20s. So I still
remember.
It'd
be nice to go back to that, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. So I can still play a teenager if I had to. I could still play a 20, because I was in that. But when it got to be that you were playing somebody in your late 40s, I think I was probably a lot more authentic than one of these 25-year-olds trying to play someone's grandfather. So you've got a wider range of experience. You don't have just the experience that you're living today, but I had all of that experience. And so I think being older and being an improviser is really a benefit from that point of view, because you've just got a lot more to draw from.
And how do you hold on to your point of view? Because I'll work sometimes with people that come later into improv, and they want to play, that they may be in their 60s, in some cases 70s, and they want to play the young people's game. They want to play the 20s and 30s. They want to play that. How did you hold on to your core?
I just tried to be as honest as I could in the moment and come from a place of truth and feel, you know, express what I was actually feeling in that moment, or what that character would be feeling in that moment, as opposed to trying to, it's a fine line, because, you know, it's different than stage acting. You know, I mean, acting, you know what I mean? Like, you know, yes, in a play or something like this. And and you have to be, you're in the moment. So the strongest thing to do is just come from your own truth instead of trying to live someone else's truth. You know, if there was a character that asked for, you know, that called for a young African-American woman, I'm not going to play that. You know what I mean? It's just not, you know, not part of my life experience. And it's a part of plenty of other people's life experience. I'm not going to go there. And it has to come from my own truth at some point.
And where did you learn that? Playing from your truth. How'd you develop that?
Oh, I think playing from my truth, I think probably just came right from the beginning, you know, right from improv classes. I remember one of my first improv classes, I think it was at Second City. It wasn't at the Trent. It wasn't at Players Workshop. It was at Second City. I remember Michael Gelman teaching this class, and I forget how they set it up, but somehow or another, I was told that I was a homeless man on the street. And so I went up there and did my version of what a homeless man on the street would be. And Michael Gelman called me out on it. He said, bullshit, bullshit. And I'm like, what? He goes, have you ever been homeless on the street? Like, no. Okay. It has to come from your own truth somehow. It has to come from your own truth. You imagine what it would be if you were suddenly homeless on the street. Okay. Instead of trying to pretend to be somebody you're not, imagine if that actually happened to you. Because apparently something of how I was presenting it, and I don't remember a lot about it, just didn't ring as being honest. It didn't seem to come from, in his mind, and I'm sure it was, he was right. It didn't come from a truthful place. So I learned that pretty early on, to play your own truth. On some, you know, yes, you have to use your imagination too, but there has to be some element that comes from your own experience.
So I want to shift a little here, because and I think it's important. And we talked talking about your son Charlie, who passed away last year. And the reason I find this important is that when I started out, and he was 24 when he died. Yeah. And I know I did a lot of irresponsible things, experimented, did a little cocaine, certainly drank to excess. And I think a lot of improvisers can relate to that, that behavior. And so tell us how your son died.
Okay. Yeah. And now a very special episode of Blossom. Let's drop everything from entertaining improv. I appreciate you asking about it. Charlie was probably, like you said, a pretty typical 24-year-old kid. And he was living on his own, and he was waiting tables, and he was going to UIC here in Chicago, and he was a musician, and he was a social activist. He had been part of Black Lives Matter for years, long before, you know, it became what it is now, and very, very proud of all the things that he accomplished in his short life. And as much as I would really like to focus on his life, which was extraordinary, he really did a lot of good things that I continue to learn from. I think what you're talking about is we can also learn a little bit about something about how he died. And that was that Charlie would he would drink. And that's not occasionally. He was your typical 24-year-old drinking. But once in a while, he would also, I learned later, have a little cocaine. And unfortunately, one night he had some cocaine that was laced with fentanyl. He didn't know it was, and it killed him. And he was not a drug addict, and he did not intend to kill himself. And the more I read about this since then, I didn't even know what fentanyl was. And now I read all sorts of stuff about the fact that, you know, in Cook County last year, more people died of a fentanyl overdose than died of gunshot wounds. And, you know, Chicago and gunshots. And I don't think it gets the attention that, crimes of violence do, because I think people think, they were doing something illegal. Boo-hoo. They were taking drugs. They shouldn't have been taking drugs. Sorry. And so as it also disproportionately affects communities of color and poor people. And so I think that is part of the reason why it doesn't get that attention too, it seems. But I think that what I want anybody out there to know is that drug dealers don't give a shit about you. And they will lace your drug with fentanyl, not to kill you. Drug dealers don't want to kill you. They want to increase your need. And fentanyl, when added to cocaine or to heroin or other drugs, Xanax, can make that drug more powerful, but it also makes it more addictive. And that's what they want. Instead of you coming to them once every 2 months for a little dime bag, they want you to come every week. And they figure if they can get you hooked on the fentanyl, then they've got you. And it's incredibly addictive. And that's what happened to Charlie. Most people who die from a fentanyl overdose didn't even realize that they were taking it. They thought they were taking something still dangerous, but not nearly as deadly as fentanyl. And so I guess every opportunity I have to put that out there. So thanks for asking, Jimmy. Anybody who's listening to this podcast, if I just want you to think about it and tell your friends and your kids and just, you know, be very careful out there. It's not the cocaine that Jimmy took 30, 35 years ago. Drugs have gotten a lot more dangerous out there. And law enforcement is overwhelmed with trying to get this under control. And they've got a lot of other problems to deal with too. So it's going to be a problem for a very long time.
So I went to the funeral and you did this. I mean, I don't know how you got the courage, and I'd really like to know a little about this process. You wrote out just this beautiful thing called The Elephant in the Room. If you could tell us a little about that and how you mustered the courage, the shock, the grief. I can't imagine the emotions you were going through. You wrote this it was like in a 24-hour period after you found out that Charlie had died.
Yeah, that entire week is a blur. And I think, frankly, being an improviser and having that mindset helped me get through it, because I just did my best to stay in the moment and just do what I had to do. And I don't know where I got the strength to do it, because you're right. My wife and I, my kids, my other kids, we're all in shock. And during that week, I wrote the letter that you talked about. I also wrote and delivered his eulogy. Being busy that week with those things really helped, because if I hadn't had those things to do, writing the note that you're talking about, writing and delivering the eulogy, cleaning out his apartment, talking to the county coroner, working with the funeral home, all these things to do, what else would I have done? Just sat in a corner by myself and collapsed. And so looking back on it, I can't believe how much we accomplished in that week, but I can see why we did it. It was self-preservation. The letter itself is something that the one you're referring to, the elephant in the room, we handed out at the wake, which was, you know, the funeral home said it was the largest wake they had ever handled. And people had to wait in line sometimes for 3 or 3.5 hours to see us. Frankly, part of it was I wanted to educate other people as quickly as I could. And where else was I going to get a captive audience like this to tell them, don't let this happen to you or your children? And so we printed out hundreds of these one sheet, 8.5 by 11. And I had a couple of Charlie's friends hand it out to people as they stood in line coming up to meet us. From a practical standpoint, it also saved me from having to say it out loud 800 times whenever the next person came up to me and said, I'm sorry, Brendan, what happened? By the time they got to me at the front of the line, everyone there had read that letter. And I told them to share it on Facebook. Apparently it's been shared tens of thousands of times on Facebook and I'm hoping that somewhere along the line it saved someone else. And I have heard from friends who said that they immediately talked to their own children about it. And I have to believe that somewhere out there, somebody's alive because of that letter.
How do you, with over a year later, how do you put this in perspective?
It's an ongoing process, and it's so, there's so much to it, and it's so, it's, you know, grief is just love with no place to go. So, you know, you're going to continue to share your love with your son. Instead, you have all this love that you don't know what to do with. And so you find other ways to share your love with other people. And that helps a lot. It's like you're in the, you know, when you first get hit, it's like you're on a ship that gets shipwrecked and you're in the middle of the ocean and you're grasping for anything to hang on to in the storm. And you find something to hang on to keep you afloat for a little while. And the waves come crashing. These waves of grief are constant. And as time goes by, those 100-foot waves of grief become 50 feet and they become less constant. but they're still there and they'll always be there. And you get to a point, and I don't know that I'm there yet, where, grief becomes a friend. It's weird. It's a place that you can go to. It doesn't have to be constant anymore. So I can get up and live my day and do what I need to do to move forward and do, frankly, the things that I know Charlie would want me to be doing. But I still have a place to grieve when I need to. And there was part of me that was worried that that would go away. You know, it's weird. It takes a while to get to that point, but there was a point where I was concerned that all that powerful feeling that I had would go away, and it doesn't. It doesn't. I still grieve for him every day, but it's not overwhelming.
And when you look at the support you got from your friends, from the improv community, how important is that when you look back at your improv career?
Yeah, it's really important. It's really, comforting to realize that even after all these years, I'm part of this community, social media has really helped out a lot on to keep me connected to people that I don't see very often, that, many of them came to the wake or to the funeral, some of whom I've seen a lot, some of them I hadn't seen in a very long time. And if they weren't able to make it, I got a lot of wonderful letters and notes and, you know, candles and gifts and remembrances for Charlie. And, that has really been powerful. This improv community, if you're out there, don't take that for granted at all. It's not, it's uncommon, but it's part of what makes improvisers who they are, is that it is about, it's you're with a group of people. Even when you're on stage, you're not up there by yourself. You're being supported and you are supporting other people. And it's a very, very positive way of life, not just on stage, but off stage. I tell you, when sometimes I'll do a corporate gig. It's been a little while now since this COVID thing, but sometimes people ask me to put together a group of improvisers for an evening of performance for their corporate group, whatever it is. And, my favorite part is always the ride in the van to the gig and back. I mean, the show is okay, but hanging out with a group of like-minded people who are listening, who are in the moment, who are positive, who are building on whatever somebody throws out there, even in a conversation, not a performance at all. But it's so empowering to do that. And if every group, of people that you hang out with was as supportive and positive as an improv group, everything would be better. And I think, when I'm not around it, I miss that the most.
So we got to wrap this up and we end the podcast the same way. What is one piece of advice you'd give to an improviser starting out today?
One piece of it's a whole lot different. The community is a whole lot different than, it's a lot more sophisticated than when Jimmy and I started. And there's a lot more improv out there, and there's a lot more opportunities out there. And sometimes I feel that people are looking too far ahead. They're looking at the prize instead. They're trying to get on Saturday Night Live, or they're trying to get onto this writing staff, or they're trying to make it onto the main stage, and everything is focused on that. And what I would like you to remember is that it's, in the long run, you'll be much better off just being in the moment and not worrying about the future so much as just being present. Be present all the time. And when you're on stage, don't be thinking about, ooh, Lauren Michaels could be out there. Just think about the people who are on stage with you and help them, and that'll be good.
Brendan Sullivan, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
My pleasure, Jimmy. Thanks.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank our guest, Brendan Sullivan. And I'd like to also thank Dan Schiffmacher, the producer, the editor of Improv Nerd. He is the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you would not be hearing my voice right now. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning Art of Slow Comedy improv classes, workshops, and intensives, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also, sign up for my Improv Nerd blog. Get on the mailing list. If you want to follow us on Twitter, go to improv_nerd and like our Facebook page, Improv Nerd, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel. And if you want to write a good review, find a good place to write it. I don't care if it's a bathroom wall. I don't care if it's on the car, someone's car windshield. But it's better if you found it like, on iTunes or something. But whatever, because it helps me get through the winter. And I want to thank you especially for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.